I'm Paul Vanvis, the host of Curiosity Never Retires, a podcast from OLLI at American University. OLLI is a national adult education program dedicated to providing curious, mostly retired people an opportunity to teach and learn subjects that they have always been interested in. OLLI at American University provides that opportunity on so many topics that we thought it was a good idea to give you a peek at a few of them to help you decide what classes you might be interested in. Our guest for this episode, Howard Spendlow, is actually teaching two courses this fall, one on China's early history and the other on Japan's early history. Welcome, Howard.
Thank you, Paul. Really glad to be here.
Howard, you've spent your career studying and teaching the history of East Asia. Now, these are two of the world's oldest cultures. How far back do your classes go in each country's history?
All the way back to archaeology and the earliest formations of cultures we later come to call, quote-unquote, Chinese and Japanese. And for China, we have the advantage of an indigenous written record going back to the second millennium BCE. For Japan, we have to wait until the 8th century of the Common Era when they finally begin to write down the ancient myths of Japan's origins after they'd imported a writing system from China. In terms of coverage, in the fall semester for China, we should get up to about the 13th century when the Mongol Yuan dynasty marks the first time that all of that territory we now call China gets controlled by a nomadic Central Asian people. For Japan, we'll get up to 1868. 15 years after Commodore Matthew Perry forces an end to Japan's two-century period of self-imposed isolation and helps precipitate an end to 700 years of military dominance.
So China is a vast Asian mainland nation, while Japan is a relatively small but powerful island. How did their geography affect the development of each society?
Immensely, and that's why we start each semester with a whole unit on geography and climate and things like that. The fact that Japan is an island nation meant that for close to 200 years, they could severely limit all contact with the outside world. But were never completely cut off. In fact, they could see what was going on in the neighborhood, especially as the Spanish began to colonize the Philippines, and the Japanese could take steps to preserve their independence. So by the beginning of the 17th century, maybe a third of a million Japanese had converted to Roman Catholicism. Within a few decades, the faith was effectively suppressed. China, on the other hand, covers a huge area of subcontinental proportions. It contains the starting points of major trading routes, later known as the Silk Road, that connected the heartland of China's civilization with the Eastern Mediterranean. And another major factor is that the east coast of China benefits from a monsoon weather system that promotes some of the most productive agriculture on the planet. Further inland, to the northwest, however, we get to an area where monsoon rains don't reach, and there's a real but invisible and shifting dividing line between the two. Why look at that? China's early history has been involved conflict between peoples who practice sedentary agriculture and peoples who survive by practicing nomadic pastoralism and by raiding the farmers.
So are you going to focus on the historiography of each nation or look more closely at other aspects of each, like political, economic, and social developments?
All of the above. We do focus on historiography, the study of history, because these are two very history-conscious nations. Although one of the points I make along the way is that the way these countries present their own history, particularly in the modern era for political reasons, doesn't always accord with what the actual historical record reveals. And unfortunately, we won't have much time to cover literature and art for China. But for Japan, we will also touch on the aesthetics of calligraphy, poetry, printmaking, and landscape architecture.
Howard, we've talked a little bit here about all of the various factors that you're going to look at in the history of both these nations. But there's always a point, I think, in a nation's history where individuals can have an outsized effect on the history of that country. Tell us about somebody in Japanese history who had an effect on the long arc of its history, and then maybe somebody in Chinese history that had the same.
Okay. For Japan, one of my favorite characters is a guy named Benkei, and actually he didn't have much of an impact on history, but is a really colorful character. He was what's known as an aesthetic monk, And he lived at a time of great turmoil in Japan when the imperial household was losing power and the military class was beginning to rise up. And he felt that the samurai class, which was just emerging at that point, we're talking about the 12th century here, that the samurai class was really corrupt. So he went around beating up on samurai and collecting their swords, and he vowed to get 1,000 of them. He was up to 999, and he meets on a bridge, and now we're getting into real myth here, but that's what the stories are for. He meets on a bridge someone who looks very, not very impressive, but they fight, and Benkei loses. And he is pissed off, so he goes back again, and they fight again, and he loses again, so he decides he's going to become this guy's retainer. So the story Benkei gets remembered by is that Yoshitsune, the kid brother, finally takes refuge far up at the very far north of Honshu, the main island, and his brother goes after him. And Benkei, who apparently stood about 6'8", stands at the bridge to guard his patron. And people keep firing arrows into him, one after another, and he still stands there and takes it. And then finally, when the siege is over and Yoshitsune has committed suicide inside, they realize that Benkei had in fact been killed. But this is called the standing death. He still didn't fall down, and that has earned him a role in Japanese literature, in woodblock prints. He's the subject of kabuki plays and things like that, so he's a really colorful character. So that's Japan. Now, let's go over a little bit earlier to China. Now, Japan, over the years, has had a number of female emperors, none since the 18th century, but that's another story. In China, being unaware of the history of other countries around them, they pride themselves that only once has a woman actually ruled as an emperor regnant. And I've got to point out that the term emperor in Chinese is not gendered. So emperor, empress. Empress Wu in the Tang Dynasty is the only woman who actually did reign as emperor. How did she do this? Well, she worked her way up from concubine of the second emperor and then also of the third emperor, displaces his primary wife. There's stories about murdered daughters that may not be true, but as I say to my students, it is true that these stories are told and believed by a lot of people. About 5 years after she secures her position, her husband has a series of strokes and is more and more out of commission. We can think of Edith Wilson running the White House when Woodrow Wilson had his stroke, except in this case it went on from 660 to 683 when he finally dies. So she's been empress. Now she is Empress Dowager, which means she's the widow of an emperor. Her two sons then become emperor. She can't stand what they're doing. They're too independent. So she ends up deposing them and then declares herself emperor in her own right in the year 690. And you can imagine this caused a lot of consternation. A lot of people were opposed to her. So there's a lot of palace intrigue. And there are two officials who served under her that I find particularly fascinating. One is a man by the name of Lai Junqian, and he was part of the secret police. And there's an anecdote that goes with him. There was another secret police officer by the name of Zhou Xing. And Mr. Lai at one time asked Mr. Zhou, if you're trying to get a confession out of people, how would you go about doing it? And Mr. Zhou says, oh, I just get a big metal urn and lock the guy up in it and light a fire under it and see what happens to him. At that point, Lai says, you know, I've got stuff on you. And the phrase is, will the gentleman please step into the urn? At which point, Zhou backs off. So that phrase, will the gentleman step into the urn, has come to mean hoist on your own petard, caught in your own trap, and so forth. On the other hand, there's another official by the name of Di Ranjie, and he was known as a blue sky official. He was completely non-corrupt. And at one point, Empress Wu asks him, do you want to know who's been backstabbing you and talking dirt about you? And he says, no, I don't care. So long as I've got your majesty's confidence, that's all I need to know. And she was so impressed that he has come down to us as a model of the good official, in so much so that there were stories written about him, about his investigation of criminal stuff. And now we're going to fast forward to the 1950s, where there's a Dutch diplomat by the name of Robert van Gulik on the island of Taiwan with a lot of free time on his hands. So he translates three of these Judge D stories into English. And they were so popular that von Gulick's friends urged him to write up some more Judge Dee stories. So you can get these wonderful stories. It's Western fiction, but it really does give you an insight into how the Tang bureaucracy functioned and how magistrates went about solving crimes and stuff like that.
Fascinating. Are there misconceptions in the West about these two countries that you hope your classes will correct for your students?
Are there misconceptions? Of course there are. One of the biggest is seeing the Chinese and the Japanese as unitary people. As one of my graduate school advisors said, this tendency to look at all of China as one unit simply reflects China's arrogance and American ignorance. And when we're talking about populations, China's now about 1.4 billion people, Japan significantly less, but still 125 million. There is immense diversity within each nation, and we'll be covering a lot of that.
Both of these nations are still important players in contemporary international politics. Do you think the people taking either or both of your courses will have a better understanding of these nations' contemporary behavior by learning about their early history?
I sure hope so, absolutely. At the very least, these courses in the fall will provide a foundation for the courses I hope to offer in the spring. And in the spring, we're going to investigate China's and Japan's very differing responses to 19th century imperialism and then global warfare in the 20th century.
Howard, thank you for taking the time to talk about your classes. They sound fascinating.
Always happy to do this.
Curiosity Never Retires is produced by myself, David Flaxman, Andrew Hiller, and Jesse Williams, and is presented by Ollie at American University. Our theme is education music from background music for video by Pixabay. We hope you can join us again for our next look into Ollie at American University's fall offerings. For Curiosity Never Retires, I'm Paul Vanvis. Take care.